Bob Murphy Show, episode 20.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome everyone to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. Today I have a very special guest, R. Nelson Nash. He is the author, most famously, of the book Becoming Your Own Banker. And in there, he explains what is called the infinite banking concept, or IBC, which allows you to use dividend-paying whole life policies structured in a particular way to act as a financing vehicle. And so that's the sense in which you become your own banker, because what's happening is you build up your cash value in one of these properly structured whole life insurance policies, and then there's provisions that allow you to borrow against it. So you're borrowing from the life insurance company in what's called a policy loan, and that's the way you raise money. So it allows you to wean yourself off of outside lenders, and that's the sense in which you become your own banker. All right. And so that's, I've known Nelson quite well. I work with Carlos Lara. As many of you know, the Lara Murphy Show is the podcast I have with him, where that's just talking about Austrian economics and IBC. So what we're doing for this interview is we get into IBC a little bit near the tail end, but I want to just be talking to Nelson Nash, the man, and just kind of understand his background and his life experiences and that sort of thing. So he makes an allusion in the interview to Paul Harvey, you know, and now you know the rest of the story. So what I will do here for the formal introduction, just for those who don't know, I'll read a little bit of this. A native of Georgia, Nash received a BS degree in forestry from the University of Georgia, 1952. From 54 to 63, Nash worked as a consulting forester in eastern North Carolina. During more than 35 years' experience as a life insurance agent, Nash worked with the Equitable Life Assurance Society of the U.S. and with The Guardian. Recognized for his high achievements, Nash was inducted as a Hall of Fame member by Equitable, a chartered life underwriter and life member of the Million Dollar Round Table. A pilot for 60 years, Nash flew with the Army National Guard and earned Master Aviator wings during his 30 years of military service. And then his official bio ends this way. He has been married to Mary W. Nash for more than 65 years. That number's actually higher. We'll get to that in the interview. The couple live in Birmingham, Alabama, and have three children, 10 grandchildren, and 6 great-grandchildren. So let me just round out the background to say that with Carlos Lara Nelson and then his son-in-law, David Stearns, we all formed what's now called the Nelson Nash Institute, and we, you know, exists obviously to promote Nelson's work, both for the general public and for financial professionals who want to see how can they incorporate IBC into their professional lives. The website of that is infinitebanking.org. And we also set up a training program for financial professionals who want to use IBC. And so that's how I'm related to all these people professionally. But as I say, let's go ahead and start the interview talking to R. Nelson Nash to understand his interesting life journey. Well, hello, Nelson. Thanks for joining me on the Bob Murphy Show.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, yeah, it's several people have been telling me, hey, you got to get Nelson on there. And I was like, yeah, I do need to get Nelson on here. So as always with people that I think a lot of my listeners know about, I'm going to first focus just, you know, on your biography and to sort of let them know more about how you became Nelson Nash. So obviously, as I said, as I already explained to people in the introduction, you're famous for your work on the infinite banking concept or your discovery and development of it. But let's spend some time first just talking about your background, if you don't mind. So
sure.
I've heard you many times refer to your older brother in your talks and whatever. Was it just the two of you or did you have other siblings?
No, there were four of us. I'm number three.
Okay. And so I'm wondering too, did that, like, is he, I don't know, was there a typical relationship of the older, younger brother? Like, you know, was he always kind of domineering over you growing up, or was he more your protector against the neighborhood kids, or how did that work?
Oh, they were two totally different people. Willis, my oldest, was 7 years older than me, 4 years older than my next older brother, J.Y. Mm-hmm. So J.Y. and I were closer relationships than my older brother. My older brother is kind of a model, I guess you might say, to me, but I didn't have all that much contact with him growing up, no.
Okay, and so the one who, J.W., is that what, or J.Y.?
J.Y., yeah.
J.Y.
Yeah, he was a big-time jock.
Okay.
Yeah.
So was it like he was a cool guy and you kind of idolized him, or is that not how it worked?
Oh, no, he was the meanest guy you ever seen in your life.
Okay.
He would just love to beat up on people and stuff like that. And because, like I say, he was a big time jock.
Okay. Now this is sort of my hobby horse here. So just indulge me. And obviously, if you think this is off the wall, feel free to say so. Yeah. But I often, when I see people, I know them as adults, and then I learn about, you know, their order in terms of siblings and stuff. Like, sometimes their personality makes more sense to me. And probably 90% of it is just I can make up any story to make it fit the facts. But I'm just wondering, like, growing up, because I hope you don't think I'm going on a limb to say you've got kind of like an assertive, you know, stand up for yourself personality. You know what I mean? Like, you're not going to take any garbage from anybody. Do you think growing up with that guy as your older brother kind of made you have to develop that stance towards the outside world?
No, I think that developed over a period of time. I was not all that aggressive in my grade school years and stuff like that. So there was a change about time I was 13 or thereabout.
Okay, fair enough. So good. I'm glad when people say, no, Bob, I don't think your theory works there. Good. So another big aspect, of course, of your modern persona, the people who know you, is your deep Christian faith. So I'm just wondering, like, were your parents religious? Is that where you got that from?
Oh, very much, yes. We were poor as church mice financially, but we was very rich in Christian upbringing. And so I became a Christian when I was 9 years old.
Okay. And are they Baptist? Is that correct or
Baptist,
not?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. I wanted to ask you also another thing that people know about you, of course, is your long-lasting marriage to Mary. And I'm wondering, is there anything, like, I've heard funny stories about, like, when you guys first started dating. I don't, if are you able to share anything of that? Or,
well, we could try.
I thought I heard something about, like, was she supposed to see somebody else, and you kind of told her, well, don't go see that guy, like, come hang out with me, or something like that?
She had two brothers, one older, one younger. The older brother was just 3 weeks younger than me, so we were in the same class together in high school and such, and she was 3 years younger than the two of us, and so she was just Dickie's little sister,
mm-hmm.
And she grew up. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Anyway, back during the high school years and so forth, there was one girl that I dated for maybe a year and a half or so, something like that, maybe 2 years. And that certainly didn't work out at all. That was a gross mistake. But anyway, she was still in high school when I was starting the senior year of college. Junior year of college. Anyway, I used to go to the Athens High football games down at Sanford Stadium there that the University of Georgia uses. And so she was a cheerleader. And that kind of got my attention and such. Anyway, I asked her if she had a date or something like that. She says, yes, I do. Well, where y'all going to go? Going to the teenage canteen after the ball game is over and so forth. And so this is one of my friends that lived just four doors up from me. His name was Otis Bonner. Anyway, Otis was 1 year younger than me. And anyway, that's who she had a date with. And anyway, at the teenage canteen, cut in on a dancing with her, and it kind of ticked him off and so forth. He just went home. So I had to take her home. So first one thing led to another.
Okay, great. Yeah, I knew that there was some issue there where it was you were somewhat assertive even there in terms of, and I was like, well, yeah. I guess I'll just take a ticket and wait my turn. And no, you just said, you know, I really think you'd rather be with me. So it was interesting.
Yeah, now, you know, you remember Paul Harvey, or are you too young?
Yeah, now you know the rest of the story.
Right, yeah okay.
So can I ask you, like, was it the sort of thing that you, like, did you, I'll put you this way. At what point did you say, I have to marry her? Like, was that pretty soon, or did that develop over time?
That was fairly soon, because she just was my ideal.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. I suppose I should ask, so at this point, I don't know if you've done the math lately, but how long have you guys been married?
66. In August, it'll be 67.
Wow, that's amazing. So this is a cliched question, but I'm sure I'll ask. Any tips on, you know, what was it that you guys did, you know, so that how did you last so long? Because, I mean, that's pretty amazing.
I do what she says.
Okay. Happy wife, happy life. Yeah.
And isn't that the stock answer?
Yes. Is there, I mean, that perhaps that is the answer, but anything else for someone who wants more specificity there?
Well, we know what the word commitment means.
Mm-hmm.
That's a foreign word to most folks in the U.S. today.
Right. And I suppose, you know, she's also, you know, religious. You, like, you guys go to church together and things like that.
Yeah, she was a Methodist, and I was a Baptist, and Methodists are okay once you wash them. So anyway, she became a Baptist immediately, even before we were married. She was baptized as a Baptist before we were married. So,
okay, great. Yeah. Well, that's very good. I guess another component that people know about, but I'm curious just to get more of the details, is you spent a lot of time as a pilot. Mm-hmm. And so how did, can you just give us the backstory there? Like, how did that happen?
Oh, it's amazing. It's how things work out. When you say airplanes, you're talking about a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've already explained to you that we weren't noted for having wealth, financial wealth at all.
Right.
All right. So my oldest brother, who was 7 years older, he was in World War II. He was a parachute rigger in the Army. It was not the Air Force in those days, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was stationed in the Aleutian Islands.
Can I ask you, you're saying the Air Force didn't even exist as a separate branch?
No. Okay. No, the Air Force didn't become the Air Force until I was in college.
So what was it, like the Army had like the Air Division or Air Corps or something?
Army Air Corps, yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah, anyway, so here's the war years, and here's the chain of islands in the Aleutians. They come down and then go up kind of a bit of a wide V, and Amchitka is the one right there where the bend in the chain is located. Anyway, we didn't know he was there. Everything was hush-hush, and all your mail was edited and stuff like that. It was that kind of world. So anyway, here was this guy that was in his unit that he had made friends with. His name of all things was Herbert W. Hoover, Herbert Woodrow Hoover.
Huh.
Anyway, he was quite a character. I couldn't possibly describe him in this time frame at all. But it was different, we'll put it that way. So he was transferred to South Florida, Homestead Base is the name of it. It's now Homestead Air Force Base. Anyway, so brother asked him to stop by Athens, Georgia to meet us and to tell us that he was okay and where he was and such. So anyway, so from time to time, he would come by and visit with us and such. And after the war was over, decided he wanted to go to college. And housing in college towns at that time was very, very scarce. So he lived with us. Well, during the war, he made some money fixing radios and selling cars and stuff like that besides being in the Army.
Just so I can get the – so after the war ends, your brother comes home and is living at home, and he's like basically saying, can my buddy stay with us to save money because he's going to college?
Oh, no, no, brother. Brother got – oldest brother got married, so he wasn't
– okay.
So, all right.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. So, anyway, Hoover was living with us and –
so you can say there. You grew up with Herbert Hoover?
Oh, yeah. Right. Anyway, he decided he wanted to learn to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And so he bought a Piper Cub. Now, he was of the mindset that he wasn't about to pay somebody else to teach him how to fly his airplane. He let students who had soloed fly his airplane with him, and he would watch what they did and read books and so forth, and that's how he learned to fly.
So he bought a plane before he had a license?
Yes.
Okay, very interesting.
All right. Well, are you getting the drift of this?
Yeah, I think I see where this is going, yeah.
All right. He taught me. See, I soloed when I was 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That's not legal. But look, that's the end of World War II, and there are a lot of things done that weren't legal.
So, I imagine. So, how did you, what did that mean? That, like, you soloed with him, you're saying, or from a different thing, and then that was why he let you then fly his plane?
Well, once you solo, you can fly any number of planes and so forth. I spent a good bit of time, spare time, at the at a very small airfield there in Athens. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the Athens airport, so forth. Anyway, I would work there for the guy that owned the airport from time to time, helping out doing this, that, and the other. And so mm-hmm. I got a lot of free time that I could go fly his airplane, the fixed base operator's airplane, so forth.
Okay, so in the beginning, you know, you're just some kid who's working there, and they say, hey, you want to go up? And how did the adult flying and you're watching and he's showing you stuff and then he lets you take the, what, stick? Is that what you call it? Or
Stick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then to solo, does that mean the person's there watching you but doesn't touch anything? Or does it mean you're in there by yourself?
The latter.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just because you can tell from my questioning, I have no idea how this works.
I could figure that out. Yeah.
you're used to spotting ignorance. You've become an expert in that. So how I'm picturing me learning how to drive a stick shift car and whatever, and it wasn't like a 2-day affair. So
right.
Can you describe the gestation period? Like from when you first got in there, the first time you sat in a cockpit watching this adult fly the thing, to when you're flying solo, how long of a transition period was that?
It wasn't very long, maybe 2 months at max.
Oh, well, okay.
Well, anyway, so an interesting thing that came along, you know, that was October the middle, but I think it was October 14, 1946. Okay, I've built up a little bit of flying time now, I guess probably 50 hours or something like that. And next older brother, J.Y., you know, the jock?
Yep.
Okay, now he's 3 years older than me. Now, when he got out of high school, he got a scholarship to Auburn University and his quarterback. He played on the freshman team as their quarterback.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
But J.Y. was not noted for academic prowess.
Okay. Can I ask you, was Auburn like a big football school back then also? Like, is that a big deal?
Auburn and Georgia is the biggest rivalry, longest rivalry in the Southeast.
Okay, sure. I figured, but I just wanted to confirm. Okay.
Yeah, right. So J.Y. decided that he better spend a couple of years with the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's stationed out at San Diego, and he's coming home for Christmas. Now, this is Christmas from 1946.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got to show my brother my newfound talents.
Right.
And so I'm taking him flying in this Piper Cub that was owned by the little airport operator that I told you about.
Mm-hmm.
And I was showing him some acrobatics to show how good I was, okay?
Right, right.
And so I had done some Cubanates and some loops and stuff like that and such. And so I asked brother, would you like to see a stall?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. So he's sitting in back and I'm sitting out front, you know.
Uh-huh.
Well, the way you do a stall, you close the throttle and you pull the nose up to an angle where the wing stalls.
Mm-hmm.
And you kick a rudder and it will spin downward.
Right.
Well, if you turn the dang thing loose, it will stop, come out of the stall. But my point is that the instant that I kicked the rudder, the engine quit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I haven't told you is the Piper Cubs don't have starters.
Oh, okay.
Are you getting the picture?
It sounds ominous.
Yeah, yes. I'm 15 years old. Dead engine. Well, I had heard of a guy that had engine quit on him like that, and he put it into a steep dive, and the force of the wind spins the propeller and cranked back up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so I started that, and it flipped one time up on compression stroke and stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Now we got to find a place to land.
With no engine.
Yes. Anyway.
Hey, let me just make sure I'm getting you. So obviously you had never tried to do a stall before. This was the first time.
Oh, yes. I'd done many, many stalls before.
But in a different plane? Is that
the issue? Yeah.
Okay. I'm saying this issue of you for, oh, gee, it doesn't have a starter.
Oh, no, none of them had starters.
Oh, so the dive, your plan was to do the dive to restart it?
Yes.
Okay, I got you. I thought you meant you realized at that moment, oh, wait a minute, this doesn't have a starter. Okay,
no,
I got you.
All those small planes at that particular time did not have starters.
Okay.
You had to hand crank them.
Right, okay.
Anyway, I misjudged the small area we had in the land in the sheep pasture. And so I had to stall a little bit higher than what I normally would be to land. And when it did, the landing gear spread and the right wing broke off and my teeth bit the instrument panel. And so I lost my two front teeth on that panel of that airplane. Now, the connection here is that there's that song that came out, all I want for Christmas is my two front teeth.
Sure.
And that was the Christmas
that's
I broke my nose.
So okay, well that's so. What you so you guys you know crash landed?
Yeah.
And then what happened? Did you like? Did you say something to your brother? Like, hang on, or you know?
Oh, he had no difficulty at all sitting back there and. anyway, it was an interesting experience.
So when it was done, like, was he swearing at you or was he white as a ghost or was he just like, yeah, you idiot? Or I'm just curious, like.
I would say it's more like shock.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I guess, yeah, because there's only been a few times, like I've been in a car and I've seen like an accident about to occur, you know, you kick it. Like, you don't really have time to be afraid. Is that what happened to you? Like, you just were in auto, like, no pun intended, autopilot, and were just doing what you knew you had to do to not get you guys killed?
Or were you? I was doing the best I knew how. We'll put it that way.
Okay. Well, that was, it must have been a good story when somebody said, "How'd you lose your teeth?" And you're like, "Ah, I crashed a plane," you know.
Yeah, right. Right. Well, the interesting thing, I guess, too, is that Mother didn't even know I'd been flying.
Oh, okay. And so did you tell her what happened, or were you kind of, or how that happened?
Well, it was, I don't know how to really describe it. Like I say, I didn't mean that she didn't know I wasn't flying that day. She didn't know I'd been flying at all.
Oh, right. That's what I'm saying. So when you went home with missing your teeth, like, yeah, were you trying to just keep your mouth shut around them, or like,
no,
was
no,
it like,
yeah, no, doggone, the nerves are hanging down there.
Oh, gee.
From the teeth.
Right.
Like I say, it was an interesting experience.
Okay. Very good. Very good. So then, beyond that, though, I mean, so you just, was it your hobby to fly, or did you do military service? I'm getting mixed up in terms of
No, second, third, fourth grade, Athens, Georgia, we lived across the road from the airport. And watching airplanes and being a kid, I just knew that one day I had to become a pilot.
Right. Okay.
Now, coupled with the fact that during the war, my dad was a engine mechanic at the airport there, and I spent a lot of time out there. Coupled with the fact that I could do things with certain airplanes that men couldn't do, because they were so okay. There was a special airplane called Orion ST, and it's a sporty looking thing. And the cockpits are very, very small. We use the expression, "You didn't get in it, you put it on."
Okay.
Well, there was this primary flight school that the Navy had for a period of time. Anyway, the instructor pilot sat in the back seat. The student sat in the front seat. Now, the rudder pedals from the guy in front and the guy in back were connected by push-pull tubes, not cables, push-pull tubes. And that flight instructor had a real bad habit of overriding the controls of the student. And he would bend those rods.
Right.
Well, grown men couldn't get in there and put those rods in.
Right, right.
I became a specialist.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Now, the sort of things that I was doing there today would be totally illegal. I mean, a kid that young around airplanes in any airport, no way. You get away from them. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
You're not allowed here.
Now, I'm curious, do you know, technically, was it even illegal then, but nobody really cared, or was it really not even illegal?
Nobody cared then.
Yeah, right.
Like, okay. I say, it's no holds barred during that particular time.
Right, right. Okay, well, thank you. That's good. Last question on that stuff is, it's, again, for people who don't know, I read something somewhere. It was talking about plane crashes and, you know, and how air travel's gotten much safer in terms of statistics, like, you know, fatalities per passenger mile traveled. You know, those numbers are extremely low, that kind of thing. And the person writing this description said something like, people who don't know much about it, you know, think that airplanes are like these super complicated. And I said, they're basically like a toaster. Like they have the complication of a toaster, you know, talking about the few things that can go wrong, you know, like they went through several of the crashes, you know, and what went wrong. And, it wasn't like this hyper complicated machine. It was, you know, something fairly straightforward, like they ran out of gas or, you know, they, whatever. So I'm just for you know, Arna, is it the kind of thing, like, it seems like once you're in the air, it's not too hard. Is landing the real tricky thing, or is takeoff difficult also?
Yeah, we'll explain it this way. Pilots say that flying is hours and hours of boredom, punctuated by a few seconds of stark terror.
Yeah.
So
sounds like taking an economics class too.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess the thing is to understand the law of gravity and get on the ground without too much danger.
Right. Okay. So, but is it right then to say like the only real tricky thing is landing, and that's where, you know, something's going to go wrong. And I don't mean like in the tautologist sense that obviously you don't die until you hit the ground, but I mean, where would the mistake be made? Where would you need to know, like, to have a really good pilot in there versus someone who doesn't know what he's doing? Is it the landing that's tricky?
Could be, but again, none of it's all that complicated. Oh, it's a motor skill, nothing else. Mm-hmm. Now, I went on to go through the Army flight school in 1956, 10 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And that was 4 months in Texas and 3 months in Fort Rucker, Alabama. The class starts out with 120 and 80 graduate. And when we go to Fort Rucker, that's the tactics phase of the training. And we're talking about very short runways and going over 50-foot high barriers and to land and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And out of the 80 people that graduated, the typical class broke 8 airplanes. So,
okay.
So you get the picture.
Yes.
There about the landing bit and so forth.
I gotcha. Yeah.
Incidentally, yours truly finished first in both those schools.
Oh, congratulations. That's great. I know you told me a story one time, like you were flying into Mexico or something like, or maybe even south of, like more directly.
Mexico,
Okay. Yeah. Do you remember what I'm talking about? Where you like realized something about the airport you were going to and like the altitude and something like that?
Well, this was my first trip to Mexico, and I wanted to see the topography as much as I could, but we got mountains to go over and such. And Mary was with me, and so was my youngest brother and his wife. We were going to an Equitable convention there in Mexico City back in 1973. Anyway, so I had to, this airplane was not turbocharged. It wasn't something that could handle high altitudes, okay? Most of the atmosphere in the that we breathe in is in the first 10,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It bleeds off big time.
Right.
When you get the stratosphere and so forth out there, it's very, very – that's why you have to have the pressurization in your airliners and
so forth.
All right. Anyway.
Are you just saying for the purpose of like – humans being able to breathe, or you mean even like the lift and stuff from the wings that trails off dramatically the higher you get?
The latter.
Okay.
The latter.
Okay.
Anyway, I've got to go over those mountains. And so I had to do circle, climbing up through some broken clouds and such. All right. When you finally get over the mountains and the clouds are gone, and here's this dazzling little city, Pachuca, down on the side of a mountain. And I thought that it was time for me to check in with the flight service of Mexico City to give them my position. And anyway, I called and didn't get an answer.
Mm-hmm.
I called again, no answer. I called the third time and no answer.
Huh.
All right. My three passengers are beginning to sweat.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. What's going on? And about that time, I noticed that I was had my microphone turned backwards. And so I was not talking into the microphone.
Right, right.
I didn't tell anybody for 6 months. Yeah. So airplanes have been a big part of my life. I've got about 8,000 hours of flying time, half military, half civilian.
Okay, very. And then I think you've said also that's part of the reason, like when people wonder, like, how did you end up developing things? Like, you know, you were reading stuff from Fee at this point, and having a lot of time to you know by yourself, deep in thought. So that's part of to explain, you know, how you got to be where you are? It's just all, you know, that time you had flying?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Let's pause my interview with Nelson Nash to talk about the book that I co-wrote with Nelson. Along with Carl Slara, it's called The Case for IBC. So obviously this book came out well after Nelson's smash hit, Becoming Your Own Banker, in which he explained IBC to the world for the first time. So our book is coming at it from Carlos's perspective as someone who consults with business owners, my perspective as a professional economist, and of course Nelson's original vision and explanation as a way to become your own banker and the advantages of getting the bankers out of your life. That's all in this book. And it ends in the final chapter with specific policy illustrations, you know, taking real world policy illustrations for a hypothetical business owner to just show exactly how this thing works in operation. So it's not just mere abstract theory. We give you a concrete example. For more information on ordering the book, go to thecaseforibc.com. Okay, we could transition. The other big thing, again, before obviously getting into insurance, is your background as a forester. At what age did you decide that that's what you were going to do?
Oh, I thought about it in high school, late high school. I had written some papers on the forest product industry there in Georgia, and it just something that was kind of appealing to me. Mm-hmm. And so I never wavered about that. But the real truth is that I probably should have become a pilot out of the Air Force in 1952. But I was so career driven that I said, if I go to the Air Force flight school, that means that I'd have 4 years of active duty of ROTC paying back my debt for ROTC assistance in college. Well, if I just went the conventional way, it's only 2 years. And so I reasoned that, I'll be so far behind my peers in the forest industry that I'll just go with the 2 years. But, you know, when I look back at it, I should have gone the other way. But didn't.
Right.
But you can't do anything about that sort of thing. But
sure.
But anyway, there were some very valuable things I learned in forestry school, learning to think long range, also learning how to classify things. Mm-hmm. We had more courses in classification than you could shake a stick at. Mm-hmm. And if you don't classify things correctly, you end up with erroneous results.
Right, right.
And so much of the stuff that goes on out there today is just a pure old case of misclassification.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. So if I could, for people who don't know anything about it, a professional forester, is it things like, I'm just, you know, speculating here, like things like, you know, oh, this is the mixture, like different kinds of trees that, you know, interact with each other a certain way, or this fends off parasites, or this is what you want to do to minimize forest fires. Like, is that the kind of thing, or is it more like a commercial application, like this is the way to maximize?
Oh, you know, it's way more complicated than that. We were on a cordless, for instance, we were on a cordless system at Georgia when I went through. And the typical BA degree was 186 hours, quarterly hours. I had 240.
Oh, okay.
And that's in a four-year time frame. And there were 4 hours I didn't get credit for because you couldn't get to 21 hours in one particular quarter, and I took 25 that quarter.
Okay.
I'd start at 8 o'clock in the morning and go to 11 o'clock at night 2 days a week.
Oh, wow. That's, yeah, that's.
I still have a thought sometimes that, doggone, I missed the class.
It's not the same thing, but I just remember when I was in high school, they had what they call them AP classes, advanced placement. Like you could take college classes. In one semester, or year, I don't remember how they broke it up, but I was signed up for 5 AP classes just, you know, because I was bored and they looked interested. And I remember my guidance counselor was like, don't you need time for fun? Like trying to tell me not. Yeah. And I was like, this is fun. AP physics, AP calculus. You kidding me? This is fun stuff. This is great. Yeah. So I mean, if you don't mind, like, so for example, like what's something that the professional forester does that the person from the general public like wouldn't even realize, oh, gee, that's involved in forestry. I didn't even, or can you think of anything that, you know, you guys know that?
Here's these weird notions that people have, preconceived ideas. When you say you're a forester, they think that you sit in a fire tower you're a blood relative of Smokey Bear and stuff like that. And,
right.
But that's not the case at all. I never worked for the government, Smokey Bear, and I don't see eye to eye at all.
Sure. So, yeah, so that's a good point. You know, obviously I've seen your seminar, so I know that. But, yeah, so for the public who's never heard that, so you – what was it like, was it companies or was it private individuals who just owned a lot of land that had timber on it? They would hire you?
Private, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And it was just more of just, you know, they would hire you and you'd come in and would you tell them what to plant or was it already existing and you would just say this is the way to give it? Just, I realize this is so elementary to you, it might be obnoxious, but what would you do when some private person who owned a lot of forest land hires you? Like, what do you do for that person?
Develop a plan and carry out the plan. Now, I had a very interesting client at one time there. He was a captain in the Navy. He was working at the Pentagon. He was in charge of all the naval ground facilities, so forth. Anyway, he owned a substantial piece of property there in eastern North Carolina, and we got to be real good friends. And so it was, I had a lot of fun with him, but I design a plan that, you know, fits what he wants to get done and then implement that plan.
Okay. So like initially is the owner telling you things like, this is how much I'd like to, you know, I want to be able to walk through and just have forest land for like nature, yeah. Or I want to be able to bring in logging companies and make this amount, or like, is it, those are the sorts of things they tell you about, or?
There's the usual gamut of ideas that people have, but most private landowners have no real plan at all for mm-hmm. their timberlands and so forth. It's just there.
Right.
And they don't think at all. So this is where I really got started with Austrian economics, my experience there. When I got out of the Air Force in 1954, went to work in eastern North Carolina, I didn't know anything about socialism. Inherently, mm-hmm. I knew something was wrong because of my Christian upbringing. But anyway, I'm working in Johnson County, North Carolina. Now, that's tobacco country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's second largest tobacco county in the world. Now, everything about tobacco is controlled.
Right.
You can only plant so much tobacco based on how much cleared land do you have. Well, guess what? All tobacco farmers overplanted.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So there was an army of guys that were working from aerial photos that would go take that photo out to your property there, and then they would measure how much you overplanted. You got to get rid of that.
To be just let me clarify the regulatory framework. Are you saying to continue to be eligible to get federal subsidies, or it was literally the government wouldn't let you plant more than a certain amount?
All of the above.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Like I say, everything is highly controlled.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that kind of thinking spilled over into the general economy of that area
mm-hmm.
because that was the predominant income producer.
Right.
Well, that made absolutely no sense to me at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm living in this little town, Smithfield. There's 12,000 people at that time. And anyway, I'm mouthing off at a social gathering at the home of this radiologist about what I'd run into.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, sounds like you need to read this book. went to his library, got Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, read this. 10 days later at Max, I had it back in his hands, and I says, I have two questions. Where you guys been hiding this stuff? Second question, why'd you hide it from me? He says, well, if you like what you read, get on this mailing list for this journal called The Freeman.
Yeah.
Put out by FEE.
Yep.
He says, all you got to do is ask for it. Says, now, they're supported entirely by donations. And if you hadn't thrown some money at them in a year's time, they'd just take you off the mailing list. That's all there was to it.
Right.
Well, I was particularly attracted to the writings of Leonard E. Reed.
Mm-hmm.
And he became my personal friend and mentor. What a joy to get to know that guy and experience him.
Sure.
As a friend, as well as a mentor. And another one was Clarence Carson. Clarence Carson was a historian, but he wrote from an economic point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've had some real fun with these great people. I met Hazlitt and so forth, but we didn't become big time friends or anything like that. But I met him on several occasions.
Where did you meet Hazlitt?
At FEE in Irvington.
Well, yeah, they were in Irvington on Hudson. Yeah.
And of course, Senholtz, I knew fairly well because he was a fellow pilot.
Sure, sure.
He was an old Luftwaffe pilot during World War II.
Right. And he had a real thick accent, right?
Oh, good grief. Yeah. I had to listen very closely always. But he and Clarence Carson were the best of friends.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you. We could figure it out, but I forget what you said there. How old were you when that guy handed you Economics in One Lesson?
Let's see. That had to be 23, 24. 24.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I had thought you were older. Okay, so you were still a relatively young man at that point. Before then, I mean, obviously, your instincts were anti-authoritarian, but did you think of yourself as conservative or as a Republican? Like, did you even think of those labels or was that not the way you looked at the world?
Don't remind me of that. I was stupid enough to run for state Senate in North Carolina in 1960, I believe it was. Craziest thing I ever did in my life.
Wow, I don't know. I mean, I gather this is not your proudest moment, so that's why it doesn't come up often. But did people push you into that? Or
yeah,
okay. And yeah. I'm guessing that probably. Anyway, I don't want to. Was there anything of that? You know, that like, oh, you learn more about the political process from that experience.
I learned that I don't want to ever get involved in it again because that's not the way to get things done.
I don't know if I've told you this story, Nelson, but for me, that sort of thing happened. I had written a flat tax proposal for the state of California. I don't mean I was working for the state. I mean, it was for Pacific Research Institute, but it was designed, you know, at the California government's level. And, you know, it was not a Rothbardian treatise or anything, but I still think it was pretty good for what it was. And there was a guy who had just been elected, to the state, I guess, representative, but at the state level in California. And he was all gung ho about it. You know, he read the thing and he called me into his office and I'm feeling really important. Like, oh, wow, I'm making a difference, you know? And he wasn't like just a glad handler. Like he really got it. He understood it. You know, he got the logic of it and how it would work and blah, blah, blah. And he was gung ho. And he had his chief of staff sitting there who just talked him out of it by the end of the meeting. He was like, you know, whatever the guy, I forget the guy's name. Let's say it's Mark. He's like, Mark, this isn't even going to get out of the committee. The other Republicans won't let you go forward with this. If you bring forward the proposal for a flat tax, it will not get out of committee. And then when you're up for reelection, your Democratic opponent will use this to say you're in bed. You know, you're just serving the fat cats.
Yeah.
And so by the end of the meeting, you know, he was like, well, thanks, Dr. Murphy. And we'll be in touch. And I never heard from him again.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, the chief of staff wasn't evil. Like, everything he said was perfectly true. Like by the end of it, I was like, yeah, you shouldn't push my plan because it's, you know, you're going to get killed. So I just saw firsthand and like realized even if you did have a few good people going in there, the whole system just quashes it immediately.
Yep. Yeah, the system can't possibly work because it's top-down thinking, and that's man trying to play God in the pagan sense of the word. And the book of Exodus tells you very plainly, God's a jealous God. He's not going to put up with that stuff. So they always fail, but man is so stupid, he keeps trying to say do the same thing.
Yeah. Well, it's stupid, but to me lately, the thing that's really been irking me is the people are foolish.
Yes.
You know what I mean? I think sometimes the ones who are smart are the most dangerous because they're arrogant and think they can run the world.
No question.
So whereas the real stupid people are just they don't have too much ambition sometimes.
Yeah.
You brought up fees. So obviously I want to spend some time here. I'm curious, this might be goofy, but back then when you were getting the Freeman, the publication from the Foundation for Economic Education, that's what fee is in case some listeners don't know. Was it a nice glossy printed, was it a booklet or was it like sheets of paper stapled together that you got in a handwritten envelope? I'm just curious.
It was a small booklet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then it was, a mixture, because the way it is now, it's like a mixture of sort of like evergreen article. In other words, essays that could be true at any time, but also some might be more time sensitive, like commenting on the current political environment. Was it like that back then, or was it more like reprinting classic essays from Bastiat and Hayek and stuff?
The latter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And nothing political about it at all.
Okay.
To the contrary, I read Menger and I've read Mises way back there, so forth. But I think I met I read Menger before I ever read Mises. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Uh-huh. And that was because authors in the Freeman would say
recommendations by FEE and particularly from Leonard. Leonard knew more people of the free market, limited government, willing exchange way of life than anybody in the world.
Sure.
And you do know that he didn't have any degrees from anywhere.
I knew that from you. Yeah. I hadn't known that before you told me that.
Yeah.
And same thing in Henry Hazlitt.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And arguably he was pretty knowledgeable about economics and couldn't communicate.
Yeah, no question. Yeah.
How did he learn to write if he didn't get a degree? So
yeah.
So why don't you explain, I've heard you tell a story, but just to get it on the record here, how was it that you first got Leonard to come out and you actually met him face to face?
Well, when I first started reading the Freeman and so forth, I was talking about what I found everywhere I went.
Mm-hmm.
And he was this career change back in 1964 when I got in the life insurance business. And so I'm talking to those guys there about FEE and particularly about Leonard and stuff like that. And we were having a coffee break back there. I forgot what year it was right now, so don't hold me to it. One of the guys in the group said, "Boy, wouldn't it be good to have that guy come lecture to us?" And somebody else said, "Well, why don't you call him and see?" So I got up and called, and lo and behold, he was in.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't know me and such. And so I asked him, would he consider coming to Birmingham and lecture to a group that I put together?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, yes, just make it soon. This is March, I guess it was. And he said, after June, I'll be pretty busy the rest of the year, so make it soon. And then I screwed up the courage to ask him, now, what's this going to cost us?
Sure, right.
And he said, well, if you want to, you could pay for my airplane fare.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. And then he says, call Dick Stockham and John Hendon. Oh, I knew who these people were, but, we weren't on the same social level at all.
Right.
John Hendon was the only guy I knew in town that had a Rolls Royce and a chauffeur.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I went to see them and got an immediate audience when I told them why I was there. Neither would let me leave without a check big enough to cover the entire work. So that started it, and so it was every year for years.
Okay, so obviously what happened is Leonard Reed knew that in Birmingham there were some wealthy guys that were fans of Fee.
Oh,
and
yes.
It would help you cover that.
Yeah. They've been supporters, right? Anyway, he would never stay in a hotel when he came here.
Mm-hmm.
We'd always farm him out to people so that they would have, one-to-one contact with a guy like that. And so,
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit about, like, what was his rhetorical style? Like, you know, so when he first came, for example, you know, I guess you didn't really know what you were going to get. Like, how big was the crowd? Was it like an after-dinner thing, or was it, can you just give us details like that?
It was 75 to 80 people usually was the group, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And the humblest man you ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was not a forceful person at all.
Okay. And would he like try to teach economics or just like stress the importance of liberty or all the above?
All the above, coupled with the fact that he had the ability to work with economists out there that was unique.
Okay.
And you see, it was because of Hazlitt and FEE that Mises came to the United States.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he made Irvington his base of operation the rest of his life.
Yeah. And I don't remember the exact detail. Were they instrumental in getting him the position at NYU, or was that a separate thing?
I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, I did know those details at one point. Now I've forgotten them, unfortunately.
Right.
Were you the one telling me that some story about Leonard Reed, like he was in a dark room and then people were lighting candles or something like that?
Oh, golly. There's a state park here at Mount Cheeha in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a room there where we could gather that had no windows at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're gathering in that room, and we turn out all the lights.
Mm-hmm.
It's pitch black. Now, he has a paddle with a light bulb on it and a rheostat on the power supply from the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he turns on the rheostat to the point where there's a little bit of light. He says, you know, we have enough light here that we could do business if we had to. He says, I'll guarantee you another thing. Every eye in this room is fixed on that light.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he says, if I don't increase the candle power, people start looking around.
Mm-hmm.
But if I continue to increase the candle power, everybody keeps looking at that light and they can't help it. He says, your job is to increase candle power.
That's great. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I knew there was something about the angle, but I had forgotten the details.
He had a great way of explaining things, like I say.
I remember another one in particular about taking out coins and, like, the more you know.
Yeah.
Can you explain that one?
Yeah. Here's a big table, and it puts a dime on there. He says, now, that represents how much I know.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the perimeter of that dime, how it's exposed to the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
All right, then he picks up the dime and puts the saucer down there.
Mm-hmm.
Says, now I've increased my knowledge big time, but look how much more I'm exposed to how much I don't know.
Right. Yeah, that's great. So is it the kind of thing where was he full of stuff like that, or?
Oh, my word. Coupled with the fact he had unbelievable power over his delivery.
Right.
Every time that I have him down, I would try to find some other group for him to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Stanford University here is a private university, a very good school. And mm-hmm. the dean of the business school there was Bill Geer, G-E-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Geer was born in the same county I was born in Georgia. He went to the University of Georgia, and he was dean of the business school. Now, how that guy ever got that job, I'll never know. he was borderline communist.
Uh-huh.
Now, how he kept the job was even a bigger mystery, but that's academia.
Sure, yep.
All right. Now, so I'm here. I've got Leonard engaged to talk to the seniors at the business school at Stanford University. And with a limited time he had to talk, he's explaining to the students that government is a fist. All it can do is punish or inhibit, and that is action, and that is all.
Mm-hmm.
Dean Geer interrupted it in front of the students
mm-hmm.
and says, oh, no, I consider it a helping hand.
So while this visiting guy is giving a talk,
yes.
he interrupts?
Yes.
Yeah, wow, okay.
Leonard started to rebut.
Uh-huh.
He spoke two words and stopped in the middle of a sentence mm-hmm. and just smiled.
Uh-huh.
I wish I could do that.
And so what you're getting at there is that his personal style was not confrontational, that he just realized, I'm talking to the people who are listening to me?
He said, the purpose of dialogue is I'm learning from you or you're learning from me, and that is all.
Right, okay. Okay, great. Well, you mentioned a minute ago that I think it was in 1964 that you formally went into life insurance.
Right.
Can you tell us, you know, like just how did that happen?
I'm living in Eastern North Carolina, and through a sequence of events out there, the largest forestry consulting firm in the United States was here in Birmingham, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
It was known as Southern Timber Management Service. And I got talked into merging my consulting outfit in North Carolina with one here
mm-hmm.
with them. And that was a tragic mistake. I should never have done it. The embarrassing thing is I went way out of my way to get counsel from three people as to whether I should make the move.
Right.
All three says don't do it.
Ooh.
My pastor was one of the advisors.
Were they giving different reasons for why you shouldn't, or were they all saying the same problem?
Just the pastor was giving me this one. John Radley was an interesting character, but he was the one who started this consulting firm here.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he came to Smithfield to talk to me about coming down there and so forth. And of course, we had many phone calls and lots of letters and such. And I had my pastor read all the letters that I wrote to him and that John wrote to me.
Right.
And I had him meet John when he came up to Smithfield.
Mm-hmm.
And pastor says, you will never get along with that guy.
Hmm.
And I said, pastor, I asked for your help. I thank you. But the reason I'm going is because of the large client base they have and what I can offer to their business.
Mm-hmm.
What you're talking about is people problems. I can handle that.
Yeah.
Now, I can't think of a more stupid thing for me to say than that. A 30-year-old.
Sure. Now, just out of curiosity, and obviously you don't need to say it if you don't want to, but did he just mean personality style, or did he mean like his value system's different from yours and then this is not going to go well?
All of the above.
Okay, gotcha.
And 3 months down here, I saw exactly what my pastor had to say.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I said, you have made a terrible mistake, and we lost lots of what we'd accumulated. Some cash payers of life insurance is always salvaged out of that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The best advice I'd ever had financially down through the years was from a New York Life guy in Athens, Georgia, and another guy with Equitable Life in Goldsboro, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I actually answered a blind ad in the newspaper with Equitable.
Can I stop you for a second? Do you mean it was one particular aphorism those guys gave you, or you mean like continually they were giving you good advice and you just respected? Okay, gotcha. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Right. Anyway, so I spent a year deciding what in the world was I going to do. I made that answer to the Equitable. I would have walked in their front door, but I didn't know it was them.
Right.
Yeah. But I made that decision during the summer of 64 and joined Equitable in October 1, 64.
Okay. And you were, how old were you at that point?
Well, must have been 35.
Okay, give or take. Okay, great.
Yeah.
And so then you, at that point, was everybody selling whole life? Was that a standard thing, or was that still more of a niche thing that only some people specialized in?
Oh, no. Everybody was selling whole life at that particular time. But we had the perversions come along later on.
Sure, right. So just to give us a snapshot, like, so at this point, was it pretty, in the mid-60s, obviously, people nowadays who are, my age or younger, we've grown up in a world where, oh my gosh, permanent life insurance, that's a crazy place to put your money.
Yeah.
But at this point, we're still on the gold, well, you know what I mean? The weak version of the gold standard, and inflation, price inflation wasn't as crazy. The 70s hadn't happened yet. So was it still considered a nice, safe, conservative thing that, oh yeah, a responsible head of household would have life insurance in the form of a whole life policy, and you've got,
change had already started.
Okay.
We'll put it that way. There was a watershed there at the end of World War II, and you can blame a lot of it on the GI Bill.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, that was the beginning of the change. And, as time went by, I saw that somebody's leaving out something that you need for finance during your lifetime is larger than you need for protection.
Right.
And so that was the beginning of IBC.
So let me, when people, if you can remember, at that point, was it, I mean, because this is before like no load mutual funds and things, right? If I'm getting my timeline, I can't remember exactly.
They were beginning to come into being at that time.
So, so like at that point, if you're like when you were first going down this, like, do you remember, were there people who would think, oh no, for my retirement, I've got Social Security and I'm going to be in the stock market? Or was it, would they have bonds for like from utilities? That's kind of what I'm trying to get at, is was the mindset different from what it is today where everybody knows have your 401k?
It was the fixation with the stock market that had begun big time right along in that era.
Okay. That's why I was trying to know how far back did that start. Okay. So then, this idea of your need for finance is more important than your need for death benefit coverage.
Yep.
And can you tell the story? I mean, you covered this in Becoming Your Own Banker, BYOB, but there was in the midst of like a personal crisis, right? Where you were praying about some financial trouble and then like it hits you as an epiphany.
Oh, yeah. Later on. Well, the epiphany came as just a result of watching lots of the clients and the amount of interest that they paid in their business.
Right.
Was humongous.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they didn't recognize that. And our sales of life insurance is based on the usual thing about how much is the world going to miss you in case you die early.
Right, to get your human life value,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Right, yeah, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They were totally hooked on that and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so I saw that was backward. But back there in late 70s, I had indulged in Timberland real estate. Mm-hmm. And as long as I stuck to Timberland real estate, I made money. Mm-hmm. But then I got into real estate development.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And interest rates at in the late 70s was 8% on 90-day loans. Mm-hmm. If you're not prime, you got to pay 1.5 over. And I never have met anybody that's prime.
Right, right.
So anyway, I made money at that level. And then along come 80 and 81, and the interest rates went to 23%. And,
right.
I got caught owing a total of $800,000. And that's a lot of interest I wasn't expected to pay.
And that's back when $800,000 was a lot of money.
Yes. And so I saw that I could get the money from three different life insurance companies at 5, 6, and 8% interest. Mm-hmm. But it was limited as to how much money had I put in the premiums. And so I saw that I had to increase the premiums big time. And then I could borrow and pay off the snakes and dragons. Well, it took 13 years to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. And then I paid off the policy loans. Now, once you get those guys out of your life, it startled me how quickly I paid off the policy loans. Because an account that's building is way more efficient than one that's coming down. Mm-hmm. And in the process of all this, I discovered how evil bankers are.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, and that's a good. I'm glad you brought that up independently, because I did want to steer the conversation that way here in the closing segment, because I've noticed just talking with you during our weekly meetings and things that that's something I've noticed you're stressing more, readings about Cecil Rhodes and things like that. So just let me just set up the contrast. I think some people, when they hear about IBC, they view it purely as, oh, yeah, this makes sense financially, and instead of having my money locked in prison and there's tax advantages and and if I die next week and get hit by, I got a nice death benefit, that's good, and rate of return's pretty high there, ha-ha, and that kind of thing. But for you, this isn't just merely a technical financial recommendation. This is more about, the way the world is right now. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I named it Infinite Banking Concept. So first of all, we got to consider what is a concept. Why do we have concepts? So forth. Mm-hmm. Well, banking, we can't possibly live the way we live without the function of banking. The banking function is in the hands of the wrong people. Mm-hmm. It's in the hands of evil people. So the first word is infinite. Well, how do you describe infinite? You can't. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's impossible to describe infinite. When you define something, you put limits on it. So this is only limited by your imagination. The more you see, the more you see you didn't see. We're right back to Leonard's dime on the table and then the saucer, right?
Yeah, exactly. So let me ask you to elaborate, though. You've said there twice, the modern bankers are evil. And so somebody's like, well, what do you mean by, come on, it's just, I don't like everything business people do. But you have in mind specific things too, like their role in, various foreign engagements and so forth.
Well, First of all, anybody that would lend money that doesn't exist is evil. If you tried to do that in any other business, you'd be thrown under the jail.
Yeah.
But yet that has been going on for a long, long time. Well, that should never have come to pass. And you're not going to solve it top-down action.
Mm-hmm.
Only thing that you can do is succeed from it.
Yeah. So
that's why life insurance is the only thing that meets this need. It's free contract with other free people, and it cannot inflate the money supply.
Okay, yeah. So just, I know a lot of the people listening already know that, but just so people aren't confused. So there, you're saying modern banking, the way it's practiced, you know, with the aid and assistance of central banks and modern states, allows for what's called fractional reserve banking. And you're saying, if you think about it, you know, the bank is, in a sense, lending out money that doesn't exist and creating money in an accounting sense. And yeah, other businesses can't do that. In particular, life insurance companies, when you borrow against your life insurance policy and get a policy loan, the life insurance company can't just create money to give to you the way a commercial bank can.
Yeah, that's the mechanics of it. Yeah.
And so to the way you're viewing it, that yeah, this is not merely some technical thing. And oh, that might cause economic volatility. That's you. It's primarily a moral issue, and that institutions that are founded on that kind of a concept, that, you know, that's, we shouldn't be surprised to see the way the world is developing.
Well, the tragedy is our educational system does not teach people this sort of thing at all. There's plenty of information out there that would that's available and pretty much for the asking, but that's not the way things are run. And the reason for it all is because of bankers. These guys create wars and finance both sides because that's the way that they can make more money than any other way.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the biggest war is a biggest fear for a producer of all.
Mm-hmm.
And people will do most anything to try to avoid that sort of thing. And so they create wars, and then they try to tell you that they're solving the problem for you, and they're not. To the contrary, the 20th century has been the bloodiest century of all time, and people haven't understood the continuity of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
They look at just one little item here and one little item there, but they're nothing but pieces of the puzzle. But putting the puzzle together to see what is really going on, it's bankers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a problem. And it starts with evil ideas.
And just to connect what you said a minute ago about seceding from the system, that, and I'm just reiterating for people who've never heard this before. Yeah. So the idea is people who practice IBC, the infinite banking concept, and so they're getting their financing via the insurance sector. You're saying that as more and more people and businesses do that, it's one at a time, you know, taking wealth away from the control of this evil system as you're describing it. So it's, yeah. And that's all, that's within our power right now. Like, you don't have to go lobby Congress or whatever. Anybody can just decide to make that switch in his or her own life.
See, it goes back to this simple thing that Leonard taught me years ago, that governments never accomplish anything. People do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's two ways that people do things, of their own free will and through force. Force never works.
Mm-hmm.
But yet that's the one that everybody keeps going to.
Right.
The government creates a problem out there, and then they come along with another program make more control of it. And that didn't work. So people say, well, we got to have another government program. And so that's what we've got.
Yeah. Do you remember the analogy you used about, like, if you were concerned about the monopoly of the post office, and, you know, one way would be try to lobby to get rid of the their first, but that's not the way in practice we've dealt with that.
No. It's just like, when FedEx came along and UPS came along. They didn't try to put the post office out of business and so forth. They just went on and did their business.
Right. Yeah. And a more recent example, things like Uber and Lyft.
Sure.
Where, yeah, they're not directly getting rid of the taxi cab monopoly. Yeah. They're just coming, you know, to go around it. And yeah.
Precisely.
Okay. Well, great. I guess I know I've used a lot of your time here. For closing up here, do you have any sort of big picture observations or recommendations? I mean, obviously you've spent decades involved with the quest for liberty, or, you know, those who are keeping the remnant, the flame of freedom alive, as it were. And, you know, you've seen the players and different strategies and, you know, top-down thinking versus grassroots activism, education versus business ventures. Do you have any thoughts on, you know, for those who are going to carry the torch forward, you know, your observations or recommendations about strategies or tactics in that struggle?
Well, there's no magic that can solve this problem, because it's individual things that we're really talking about here. For instance, you know, I'm a Christian, you're a Christian. Let's say that some family member of mine is not a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Can I force him to do so?
No, of course not.
The only thing that counts is his relationship with Jesus Christ.
Right.
Without that relationship, nothing's going to work for him.
Right.
And it's an individual thing. It's this free contract with other free people is the only way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And many people have written about this sort of thing, but they've overlooked the uniqueness of life insurance. And so that's what I've been trying to get across all these years. And so...
So if I could try to generalize or connect those two things you said there, I mean, are you okay with saying that, and you alluded to it a minute ago, like partly how the government expands its power is people have fear and insecurity. So of course, ultimately, if you're assured of your salvation, that's pretty comforting. You know, the stuff that goes on in this world, not going to bother you too much if you know where you're going to spend eternity. But even, you know, in terms of more secular matters, if you know that, you know, the bank can't cut you off, turn off your line of credit tomorrow, and you know you've built up something that's not dependent on the volatility of the stock market, and you know you're sort of financially independent insofar as that's possible. That just gives you much more freedom of thought. And I know, like this, like Tom Woods, for example, keeps trying to get people to get multiple sources of income because he's saying, you know, the modern PC culture. The way if you're a salary employee at a major corporation, you can't say anything. You know, you get canned tomorrow if you say the wrong thing. And that's, you know, so to try to wean yourself from that system and to have your own network of support, that's one thing that, you know, that people need to be able to do. Otherwise, you can't have a free people if, you know, if they know the next recession could reduce them all to their knees and they can't feed their family.
Well, all you have to do is just listen a little bit to radios and, I guess TV too, how many offers there are out there concerning debt problems,
right?
Personal debt problems.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's such a glorious feeling when you get the bankers out of your life that they talk about line of credit and so forth. I could care less. That would never cross my mind.
Right, right. Well, I think that's a great place for us to stop. Thank you for your time, folks. We've been talking with Nelson Nash, and Nelson, I really appreciate it. And of course, I just want to officially thank you for everything you've done, both the infinite banking concept, but more generally your work to promote freedom. And so thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.